was supposed to be shared.
The September 14th, 2012 edition. Our featured guest this evening is Dr. Michael Sala, author, researcher, and factor of the Exopolitics Institute. Discussion topics this evening will be the latest field developments and recent exopolitics news. Welcome again, everyone, to A Global Focus for the September 14th edition. Trish Sheridan speaking. Our featured guest is Dr. Michael Sala, author, researcher, and founder and director of the Exopolitics Institute. The Global Focus program is broadcast on 107.9 FM New Orleans and the UFO Paranormal Radio Network. Thank you to network owner Joe Montaldo for making these programs possible. Also, to our show listeners, don't forget to stay listening to the network after this evening's show. For program debut, it is The Galactic Connections with Erica Getch to be broadcast live directly after this program. Don't miss Erica's show. It should be marvelous. Now, back to our featured guest. Dr. Michael Sala is a pioneer in the development of exopolitics, a study of the key actors, institutions, and processes associated with extraterrestrial life. His interest in exopolitics evolved out of his investigation of the sources of international conflict and its relationship to an extraterrestrial presence that is not acknowledged to the general public, elected officials, or even senior military officials. His groundbreaking book, Exopolitics, Political Implications of the Extraterrestrial Presence, was the first published book on exopolitics and explained the political implications of extraterrestrial life. His more recent book, Exposing U.S. Government Policies on Extraterrestrial Life, takes exopolitics to a new level of sophistication by revealing how the world's most powerful nation secretly manages information concerning extraterrestrial life and technology. Dr. Sala has held academic appointments in the School of International Service and the Center for Global Peace, American University, Washington, D.C., Department of Political Science, Australian National University, Canberra, Australia, and the Elliott School of International Affairs, George Washington University, Washington, D.C. He has a Ph.D. in Government from the University of Queensland, Australia, and an M.A. in Philosophy from the University of Melbourne, Australia. Dr. Sala has conducted research and field work in the ethnic conflicts in East Timor, Kosovo, Macedonia, and Sri Lanka, and organized peacemaking initiatives involving mid- to high-level participants from these conflicts. Dr. Sala founded the Exopolitics Institute and the Exopolitics Journal. He has co-organized four international conferences on extraterrestrial life and Earth transformation on the Big Island of Hawaii. Dr. Sala has appeared in hundreds of radio and television shows and international conferences for his research on exopolitics and international conflict. Michael, welcome to the show. I look forward to discussing the latest field developments with you.
Thanks for having me on the show, Patrice. I'm looking forward to it.
And Michael, just as an aside here, we'll be announcing her name next week, but our new Nevada ICAR director, first name Heather, was mentioning to me how much she admires your work, including your articles. And my, you have two articles in the last month's time, again, that are exceptional. Now, the first I'd like to just discuss with you is your article, quote, dated September 6th, 2012, quote, did Armstrong and Aldrin received death threats to keep moon secrets, end quote. Again, did Armstrong and Aldrin receive death threats to keep moon secrets? Now, my question to you, Michael, is your article makes very interesting observations on both Armstrong and Aldrin observing large UFO craft on the moon during their missions. Allegedly, they both told Dr. Stephen Greer of these sightings, which events reportedly also were known by Armstrong and Aldrin family members. Now, Michael, you must take this matter very, very seriously. What were your impressions from this news?
Well, the important thing to keep in mind is that as far as Neil Armstrong is concerned, that People have always been questioning his behavior after the Apollo landing. I mean, he really achieved something which in the American public's eye was extraordinary. And he really was set to play a very important role, a very important public role. He could have gone on to become a US senator, for example. He could have, anything that he set his mind to, he could have become, but he decided to become a recluse. He decided to basically shun the public light, the public arena. And that behavior is something that immediately got people's attention. It's like, well, here's a man who really has the world open to him, and yet he kind of runs away from it. And it's the kind of very different philosophy or very different behavior from what you would expect from the kind of alpha individuals that become astronauts. So that immediately got people questioning, well, what happened? Did he experience something that really made him behave in this very strange way? And then over the years, there were subsequent hints that something was not quite right. In the 25th anniversary of the Apollo landing in 1994, he went to the White House. Bill Clinton was there along with a number of other VIPs and Apollo astronauts and so forth. And Armstrong made this very enigmatic comment about the truth, about the covers of truth, and that somehow that this was something that is signaling that there was something that was not quite right, that he's referring to truth's protective layers. And so again, there's a hint that did he run up against one of truth's protective layers, and this explained his very intrusive behavior. And then after that, you have Buzz Aldrin going on the air and admitting that on the way to the moon, they did see a UFO, and that the Apollo astronauts, all three of them, that were in the mission, were basically trying to decide, well, how do they approach this if they communicate with NASA Cape Canaveral in a way that might make them think that they were kind of concerned about UFOs telling them that the mission might be cancelled or that might be asked to kind of like turn around. And so they decided to just ask NASA about the Saturn V booster rocket or the Saturn IV booster rocket. And so again, here you have something that is signaling that all was not right with the Apollo landing or with the Apollo mission. You have a number of people saying that there were transmissions, that there was a lost 2 minutes during the transmission time in 1969, that the radios went silent for a couple of minutes and that something was being covered up. And then it kind of became knowledge at NASA, according to Maurice Chatelain, who's a retired NASA communications engineer, that in fact they had seen a UFO on the moon, that there was a large UFO on one of the nearby craters, and that this was something that had been sighted, and that the Apollo astronauts were talking with mission control about this, and that explained the 2 minutes of silence. Now, then you have Dr. Greer going on the public or revealing his sources that he had spoken with family members of Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin, confirming that in fact they did see UFOs on the moon, and that in Armstrong's case, Armstrong and his family were directly threatened that if they went public with what they saw, that not only would Armstrong be killed, but also all his family members. And that's something that Stephen Greer signified, according to his sources, which include family members and close friends of both Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin, were very real threats.
When I read that information in your articles, Michael, and just a very quick apology here, a quick aside. Pardon, there's some noise in the background here. Some people were just running into my office now with some new news on a case. And secondly, I want to apologize. We have a great PAL Talk, a UPRN discussion room, where many of our researchers visit during the live shows. And you might have heard a little sound that said, oh, my God, no way, or something. That is a PAL Talk message that often plays in the system. We try to always filter it out, sometimes so it comes through anyway. So I just wanted to let our listeners know that happened during Dr. Timothy Good's broadcast about 6 weeks ago. Again, it's something that's totally PAL Talk caused. Now, let me as well, I guess I have to take a phone call now too as well. Michael, I also was very much impressed by your article entitled First Man on Moon Dies Along with Secrets of What He Saw, end quote. And first, you note the presence of two huge UFOs at the time of the Apollo moon landing, that photos of two UFOs watching the Apollo 11 craft were featured in the June 1974 issue of Modern People magazine, and you note an interesting transcript which you've already referenced from Apollo 11 to NASA. You also mentioned now Maurice Chatelaine and his research. Now, my question to you is on, you also referenced to as further confirmation, I'll be right there, I'm sorry, I'm going to party on the phone. Michael, you mentioned the excellent research of Timothy Good as far as a Moscow math professor, Dr. Vladimir Askaza, a physicist and professor of mathematics at Moscow University, confirming that Neil Armstrong relayed to Mission Control that two large mysterious objects were watching them after having landed near the moon module. Also, you mentioned a NASA individual speaking on this. It was an unnamed professor at a NASA symposium having quite a long conversation with Armstrong on that. And could you continue for just about 1 minute or two? I just have to take an emergency phone call.
Sure. Well, that was an article that I put out there immediately after Neil Armstrong had died, and I was just going over the various sources that said that he in fact did take secrets to the grave, and those secrets, the most important of course, was the so-called UFO sighting on the moon, which is quite distinct to what Buzz Aldrin admitted, that the Apollo astronauts saw shadowing them on the way to the moon. So here we have an incident where after Armstrong and Aldrin descend from the Apollo 11 lander onto the moon, that they saw two huge UFOs on a nearby crater.
Okay,
just watching. So, yes, I'm just talking about that incident of the UFOs on the crater watching Armstrong and Aldrin during the Apollo 11 moonwalk. And that article basically just cites various sources in saying that, in fact, yes, this was a very real incident, that it was known to people within NASA itself and also in the Soviet Union, and that top scientists in the Soviet Union had this confirmed to them by various sources, including NASA themselves, that, in fact, that there was these huge UFOs watching the Apollo 11 moon landing.
Michael, thank you for those further details. Excellent research. Now, you know, Michael, you have been studying various aspects of our space exploration and also the scientific aspect regarding possible exobiology, extraterrestrial life. I noticed another fine article. It's entitled, Curiosity Lands on Mars, Bold Step Forward or Backward in Finding Life, end quote. And you can have some excellent details there regarding the fact that the 1976 Viking mission did include a, quote, a labeled released experiment, end quote, designed by a Dr. Gilbert Levin. The Viking mission was the only Mars mission, as you note in your article, so far that was designed by NASA to detect life. And also, here you note that a team of scientists have concluded in their 2012 report that, let me see here, just the very end, quote, these analyses support the interpretation that the Viking LR experiment did detect extant microbial life on Mars, end quote. I think that's rather an interesting observation, a very important one.
Yes, well, it's a very important incident that is being described here, that in 1976 you had the Viking lander, or the Viking mission, which landed two robotic landers on Mars, and that there were two separate experiments conducted independently, and that these experiments confirmed that, in fact, they did detect microbiological life on Mars. And the experiments were, as you said, controlled label release experiments, and so they were successful. The person who designed the experiments, Dr. Gilbert Levin, He obviously put a lot of thought into designing an experiment which would be able to show conclusively or not whether or not there was microbiological life on Mars. And his experiment was successful. Two experiments conducted independently showed that yes, indeed there was. Now what NASA did immediately after that was that they decided that while this was something that they couldn't accept, and so they would run a similar experiment under different conditions to see whether or not they could replicate it. But of course, it couldn't be replicated because the initial experiment was conducted in a way where you wouldn't sanitize what was in the chambers, whereas NASA, tried to duplicate the experiment, sanitized the samples, and of course they had inconclusive results, and no, the results didn't show that there was life on Mars. So Dr. Levin subsequently decided that this experiment, this as a follow-on to his own experiments, his own two experiments, which were conducted independently, showing life did exist or microbes did exist on Mars, that the follow-on was insufficient. And so he always stood by the results of those initial experiments, and according to NASA, the inconclusive or the following experiments, which were inconclusive, basically made the whole experiment inconclusive. Now, here's the really interesting thing is that, well, you know, you would think that subsequent to that first experiment conducted by Dr. Levin or designed by him, that NASA would come up with a new set of experiments that would basically provide a conclusive answer to whether or not microbes could be found in the Martian soil. I mean, that's a pretty simple conclusion to draw. If you have one set of results showing that, yes, microbes were detected, and then a follow-on experiment using some of the same samples didn't show the same result, that you would, in subsequent missions, create or design an experiment to give a conclusive answer to whether or not microbes exist on Mars. And of course, with new technologies, more sophisticated methodologies and so forth, one would assume that the follow-on or any new experiment could be designed with that margin of accuracy in terms of whether it did give a conclusive or positive answer to the question of whether microbes existed on Mars. Now, of course, NASA has never designed any subsequent experiment to determine whether or not life exists on Mars or microbes exist on Mars. What NASA has done instead is they have pitched their whole Martian exploration program at trying to determine whether the conditions for life exist on Mars. And the Curiosity mission is even more specifically designed to look at whether or not whether ancient conditions of life existed on Mars. And this is where I think the whole Curiosity mission takes a step backwards, because one has to ask, well, why look for whether or not ancient conditions for life existed when you have a very good reason to believe that life exists in the present time frame, and all you need to do is just create the right experiments to make the decision one way or the other. But NASA never has, and has not designed any experiment, and no NASA mission ever since those Viking landers, those twin Viking landers in 1976, has ever conducted missions to determine whether or not life exists currently on Mars.
Those are very powerful comments, and eloquently said, and certainly they should be addressed. But now, Michael, I notice well that you have found another intriguing aspect here where science could reveal the existence of extraterrestrial cities in your article entitled Detecting Extraterrestrial Cities on Exoplanets Becomes Possible. The article is dated May 15, 2012. If I could quote one sentence, because it just says it all, that being, actually it's a part of it, it's a sentence fragment here, I'm quoting, citing mid-sentence, but what if the habitable exoplanet was covered by very large extraterrestrial cities generating vast amounts of heat? Could the thermal infrared signature of an alien New York City be seen using the detection method pioneered by the Spitzer telescope, end quote. And you have a wonderful analysis here of the various types, Kepler, then the Spitzer telescope with its infrared light capability. Do you think that we will be actually detecting the signatures of large alien metropolises within the next decade or two?
Well, that's the really interesting question that is raised by that article that was published back in May of this year. The NASA Spitzer Space Telescope uses infrared or infrared detection mechanisms to try to see directly what is happening on a planet, as opposed to the Kepler Space Telescope, which is an optical telescope, and it tries to deduce whether or not exoplanets exist by measuring the effect of exoplanets as they transit in front of a sun, because there you're measuring the changes as the planet goes around the sun, because the luminosity of the sun changes infinitesimally as the planet circles around it. So this transit method is what is used by the space telescope called Kepler. But the Spitzer Space Telescope uses the infrared spectrum to directly monitor what is emanating from the planet itself, as opposed to the sun, which is what the Kepler telescope is focusing on. So the Spitzer telescope is more sophisticated in terms of being able to detect exactly what is coming from the sun. From the exoplanet itself. And what I point out is that in this article is that now that the Spitzer telescope was successful in being able to detect infrared light coming from a distant exoplanet, that as you have the replacement of the Spitzer telescope coming into service in the next few years, that will give an even greater capacity to observe the light that is emanating from these worlds. So just as you can from space detect, you know, using infrared the kind of signature of large metropolises on the Earth, that the infrared light spectrum, you can see the amount of light that is generated from a large metropolis as opposed to the ambient environment around it. So for example, a large city like New York, right, from space, if you aimed an infrared telescope at New York City at night, what you would see is a red glow, which is measuring the heat which is being generated from New York at night with all of the light and so forth. And that would differentiate it from the ocean surrounding New York, where there would be relatively little heat being generated. And so that same principle could be used by the James Webb Telescope, which will come into use in the next few years, to detect whether or not you actually have alien metropolises on distant exoplanets, because with the James Webb Telescope, it would be much more powerful, and the infrared spectrum would give you a means of detecting whether or not there are these artificial heat sources on these exoplanets, and whether one of these conforms to a large metropolis.
Thank you so much for that explanation. Very intriguing. And, you know, I wasn't really fair to you, Michael, by saying, well, we within the next decade or so. But it sounds to me, eloquently explain it, that with the development of these technologies, in the future it may very well be possible to detect an exo-civilization metropolis. And let me see here. Now, June 2012, an exciting exopolitics congress in Prague, Czechoslovakia. You gave two presentations, both very intriguing. I have questions on both. I noticed as well, Michael, that we have speakers from Exopolitics, Czech, yes, and also the German, Mr. Fleischer, Exopolitics Germany.
That's correct, yes. So, yes, there are different exopolitics organisations in various countries around the world. There's an exopolitics organisation in Germany, which is run by Robert, which is quite successful, actually. He's been able to get quite a number of volunteers to help promote exopolitics, the study of various UFO extraterrestrial phenomena. And then you have other organisations in Europe, including probably one of the newer ones, which is the Czech Republic, and which is headed by Karel Razin, and he put together this conference in the Czech Republic where he had a number of exopolitics speakers come from around the world, and they were able to open up discussion about the extraterrestrial issue. And there was a lot of interest, so I can go into detail into what happened at those conferences during the conference and my presentations.
I would love that. And just to, lest I forget, there's a notation here that an ex-major of the Czech Air Force had experienced a sighting and he wanted to give his testimony. That sounds like a wonderful development there as well at that conference. And now, the first, if we could discuss, it might actually have been the second in the sequence given at the presentation. It was on extraterrestrial life and world government policies. Now, this sounds very interesting. Give me an overview of national government policies on extraterrestrial life. And again, you noted in this, as you dubbed, wonderful presentation in Turkey, a popular typology of extraterrestrial civilization, which entails with it a motivation for their visiting Earth in terms of how thermonuclear weapons may possibly interfere with propulsion systems of the advanced ET civilizations. Also several other topics foci in this particular presentation. Now, Michael, off the bat, you note the typology that was first determined by Soviet astronomer Nikolai Kardashev in 1964. Also, Professor Michio Kaku discusses this type of civilization typology. You really beautifully elucidated here, noting type 1 energy consumption, first of all, Earth would be considered a type 0 versus type 1 energy consumption based on oceans, a geothermal energy grid. At a macro level, on a planetary level, that would be type 1. Type 2, energy stellar level, entailing energy in vast quantities. Type 3, galactic level, using galactic core, black holes, super waves from center of galaxy. And here, and I know when you go into this, I'd love to mention this research finding of you that type 3 energy at the Planck energy level would entail manipulating energy to create black holes, micro black holes, wormholes, artificial wormholes, all these different descriptions are used. These people are capable of superluminal travel, and yet, if I'm not mistaken, that our nuclear weapons could upset space, the space-time continuum, and create gigantic disturbances, particularly the fusion weapons, displacing the continuum in an enormous way. Could you go into any of this? I know you can you could much more eloquently describe it than I can.
Yes, Patrice, it's really a question of trying to work out, well, why did we have this rise in sightings of UFOs, extraterrestrial vehicles, with the onset of the atomic age, that there was something happening with the atomic age that really got the interest of extraterrestrials, and then you had the development of hydrogen thermonuclear weapons, and it just continued to be an upsurge in the number of UFO sightings and visitation. And of course, people have often questioned, and there have been a number of attempts to try to understand the relationship between nuclear weapons and extraterrestrial visitors and UFOs, and there's various sources that basically describe how there has been, ever since the Roswell crash, UFOs have often been witnessed near nuclear weapons facilities, and so there's a long history demonstrating that there is some clear connection between extraterrestrial vehicles and nuclear weapons. Now, the question is why? You know, why is that? I mean, obviously we think of nuclear weapons and we think in terms of, well, you know, if they're detonated, especially hydrogen weapons, well, they can cause, you know, catastrophic damage here on the Earth, and then, you know, there might be some environmental spillover, but as far as the effect on space is concerned, we don't see it as really having any kind of direct effect on space. I mean, after all, they were detonating hydrogen weapons in the upper atmosphere in the early 1960s. Scientists wanted to see, well, what would be the effect of detonating hydrogen weapons in the upper atmosphere. I mean, as crazy as it would sound, but that is in fact what they were doing in the early 1960s. And because the scientific community was concerned and the national security agencies are concerned, the important thing about nuclear weapons was that they could wreak damage on the Earth, but the wider impact was not really known. So what was the wider impact? And so in that presentation we're talking about, my second presentation at the Czech Republic, which is available on my website for free, people can watch both of the presentations for free. I basically go through the typology of extraterrestrial civilizations, as you just outlined, and I spend a little bit of time looking at a Type 3 civilization in terms of, well, what would this tell us if we have civilizations that have attained this level of Type 3, where they're able to manipulate energy at the quantum level so that they could do things like travel through space-time using wormholes and so forth. Well, what would be some of the things that they would be concerned about as far as these developments on Earth are concerned? Well, the connection is pretty straightforward once you think about it a little bit, because Einstein did determine a direct connection between gravity and energy, and that there was mass and energy, of course, we know energy equals mc squared, so there's a direct connection between energy and mass, and then there's a connection between time and energy and gravity, which is the general theory of relativity. So what we know is that gravity can be something that is can influence time. That the larger the gravitational impact of a body, time slows down. So that is something that Einstein's general theory of relativity has observed. Now, what is not known, of course, in the general scientific community is the direct relationship between energy and gravity. Right? That is not understood. As far as conventional scientists are concerned, gravity is something that results from different masses having this influence on one another. But what we do know from things such as from the Beaufort-Brown effect and the expert Thomas Townsend-Brown is that there is a direct relationship between electromagnetic energy and gravity. That the larger energy that is created, like an electrostatic energy that is created, the more the anti-gravity effect that can be generated. So basically what that tells us is that if extraterrestrials are able to manipulate space-time by being able to generate these huge amounts of electrogravitic energy for propulsion, and that this influences their gravity, that is also how they can move through space and time. So what happens then when you have hydrogen weapons detonating? I mean, you have an incredible burst of energy, and that burst of energy sends these shock waves, if you like, gravity waves throughout the immediate space-time continuum, which means that any extraterrestrial vehicles that are traveling in the vicinity of the Earth would be hit by these shocks, by these gravity waves that are enormous, because they have been generated by these enormous thermonuclear weapon detonations. Because it is one of the things that science mistakenly assumes is that thermonuclear energy is natural. I mean, that assumption comes from observing the sun and saying, well, the sun is creating, you know, billions and billions of thermonuclear detonations every moment, because that's how the sun operates. It's basically a thermonuclear generator. But there are various other sources saying, well, that's incorrect, that the sun is more like an huge electrical generator, and that this connects the sun with other solar bodies throughout the galaxy. So basically, if that is correct, and the sun is a solar generator, that means that when you detonate a hydrogen bomb, it is not something that is common. It is very uncommon. And a hydrogen bomb will create these gravity waves go out throughout space-time, generating these enormous ripples or waves that can disrupt the propulsions of various extraterrestrial civilizations as they're moving through space using these advanced technologies such as anti-gravity, wormholes, and so forth that I referred to in the lecture. So, like, the metaphor I use, an analogy for how to describe this, is that, well, if you imagine a pond, and you have a little, say, electrical boat on your pond, and you're just kind of moving around, or just say you're in a little boat on a pond, a small lake, and you're moving around, and someone throws a pebble in the lake. Well, you're hardly going to feel it. It's just going to ripple throughout the lake, the wave that is generated from that pebble entering into the lake will ripple throughout the lake, and it will be just a small effect. But if you have a bigger ripple, just say throw a big stone, or just imagine another boat coming by, moving along, a speedboat, that would create larger waves, and then you would feel that, and that would be very disruptive. Or imagine if you had some kind of something falling out of the sky at a high velocity into that lake, it would create a tsunami, and you might even be killed from that. So that's the analogy I use for describing why extraterrestrials are very interested in the thermonuclear programs of the major nations of the planet, and why from very early on they've been very interested, not so much purely out of a benevolence for Earth. Maybe for some of these extraterrestrial civilizations, they're probably very indifferent to the Earth. You know, they couldn't care one way or the other whether we flourish and grow or whether we destroy ourselves in some future cataclysm. But what they are concerned about is these very dangerous weapons that we've created, which can create these very dangerous ripple effects, these very dangerous gravity waves, which can disrupt the space-time continuum in this vicinity of space.
Thank you so much for that information. It's certainly very thought-provoking, and it does segue as well. If you don't mind, I'd like to jump back and forth between these two lectures at Prague. But the second lecture of yours was entitled The Development of U.S. Policy on Extraterrestrial Life and Technology. Now, you made two very interesting observations, Michael. First of all, that on July 18th, 1952, George Van Tassel sent a letter to Air Technical Intelligence Center at Wilson Air Force Base on behalf of the extraterrestrials, with the gist that there was a great danger through the use of hydrogen bombs, and also referencing the opposition of certain very well-known scientists of that era to the bombs, and that letter was received by the United States Air Force on July 22nd. And here is the fascinating tie-in. You think that perhaps the there were several flyovers of Washington, but you believe that during the three successive weekends from July 12th through July 27th, 1952, there occurred major flyovers over Washington, including the Capitol area, the White House, and the Mall, during the presidential campaign that year, of course. And these flyovers were witnessed by so many, tracked on radar, jets were scrambled. And you believe that there might be a connection between these July 12th through 27th flyovers of Washington over Washington by UFO craft and that July 18th, 1952, George Van Tassel letter to the United States Air Force, specifically Air Technical Intelligence Center at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base.
Yes, that was a very interesting phase in human history, because in 1952, President Truman made the decision that the United States would go ahead with the development of hydrogen thermonuclear weapons. It wasn't a popular decision. There were a number of scientists that were opposed to that decision. Robert Oppenheimer is probably the most famous. He was the one that developed the atomic bomb, the fission bomb, and he was opposed to the development of the hydrogen weapons because he saw them as being irresponsible. He really thought that these weapons were just far too destructive and there was no real need for that. And so there were a lot of scientists that supported Oppenheimer, and so there was a lot of dissent about developing these weapons and whether they were needed at all. But of course President Truman decided that he would go ahead with the development of the very first hydrogen bomb, and in fact it actually did go off just before the presidential election in 1952, November 1st, if memory serves me correct. That's when the very first hydrogen bomb was detonated by the United States. And that was a decision that Truman had made, and that he, during the summer of 1952, this was a period when, obviously, the groundwork was being laid for carrying forward with this program to develop the hydrogen weapons. And George Van Tassel began receiving communications from a being calling himself Ashtar. Now this is also a very interesting historical footnote, because this is the very first time the name of Ashtar was ever mentioned. Now Ashtar, there are quite a few people that claim to be channeling Ashtar, who claim to be belonging to the Ashtar Command. It has become a very popular thing, and of course in 1973 you had that very famous transmission in Britain from ATN, the Vulian communication. Allegedly Vulian was a member of the Ashtar Command, something that also was very mysterious and couldn't be explained. But so the whole Ashtar Command and the individual called Ashtar, that all dates from this era, from George Van Tassel. He was the very first person to refer to Ashtar, and so he received the communications from Ashtar basically saying that nuclear weapons were very dangerous, and that on behalf of the Ashtar Command, Van Tassel was asked to represent them and write a letter to the United, the various policymakers, in particular the US Air Force, asking them to basically reconsider the policy of going forward with the development of nuclear weapons, with in particular thermonuclear weapons. Now, what's interesting is that Van Tassel's letter happened at the same time as Ashtar was telling Van Tassel that just to show the Truman administration and the U.S. Air Force that the extraterrestrials were serious about this, that they were going to be conducting a series of very obvious flyovers of major U.S. population centers, including Washington, D.C. And that is exactly what happened. So there you have the Washington flyover being something that was directly related to the Van Tassel communications to the Air Force about the concern these extraterrestrials about the nuclear weapons testing program that was underway. And of course then you had the desert landing incident a little bit later with George Adamski, but that's a different story. But again, it just shows you the concern the extraterrestrials were having about the nuclear weapons program.
Boy, those are very intriguing comments and excellent research. Now, you know, on Adamski, I have a big note from your presentation you're referencing the account of Adamski saying that he met with Orthon, an extraterrestrial landing occurring on November 20th, a little more than 2 weeks after the first testing of hydrogen bomb on November 1st. I'm wondering if that's the Ivy Mike bomb.
Yes, correct. That's the very first hydrogen bomb test.
Boy. Now, I hope here I'm not going to be just asking questions on tangents. Pardon me here. We've got some new developments here at the office, totally not related to this interview. I'd like to note as well to our audience again that Dr. Sala has really wonderfully described the different that occurred when our very brave pilots, both from the U.S. and NATO, were called to scramble. in pursuit of UFO craft. And you mentioned here a wonderful event, a wonderful case, rather, Milton Torres. He's certainly a fine witness, is probably the way I should describe it. He was stationed in 1957 in England. He was scrambled with a jet, and that was an F-86 Sabre jet from Kent, England airfield to a target over East Anglia. He had 24 missiles on board. He believes the target was moving 5,000 miles per hour. He also gives a reference at one point to a Mach 10. And his superiors couldn't tell him what happened. He was debriefed after the incident. And I guess he wasn't able to fire his rockets or fire them successfully. I'm not quite sure on that point, but the craft was not affected. And I remember, I believe at the same X conference where you also were presenting, Michael, that Milton Torres was very moved when he gave this account to the audience, and also at the press club at the press conference at the National Press Club in Washington, D.C., the Monday thereafter. He could finally note the account to the public because the incident had been released by the UK government. The Ministry of Defense accounts on that had been released. It was one really interesting case.
It was a fascinating case, and it revealed a number of very important policies that had been implemented secretly. One, of course, was that there were shoot-to-kill orders that were issued to various NATO pilots and, of course, US Air Force pilots in similar circumstances, that they issued shoot-to-kill orders when they saw UFOs, and if the UFOs didn't respond to any communications in terms of landing or behaving in a way where the Air Force could apprehend them, that there were these shoot-to-kill orders. So in that case that you described from 1957, Milton Torres, being a very young pilot, goes up there, he scrambles, and with these 24 missiles, he is told to get a lock on the on this what appears to be a giant UFO mothership about a mile wide, capable of travelling up to Mach 10, as he saw it travel a little bit later when it kind of flew away from him. But he was told, to basically fire upon it. He got a radar lock, and he was in the process of basically getting the missiles to launch when the UFO took off. So he actually was given the orders to fire the missiles to destroy this UFO mothership. His weapons went through the necessary kind of radar locking procedure. And then before he could actually press the button to send the missiles on the way, the UFO flew off at Mach 10, and so he didn't have a chance to actually fire the missiles at it. And then when he returned to base, this is where something very interesting happened. He was told not to report to his commanding officer and that he would be met and debriefed. And so then he was debriefed by something that looked like a civilian, and basically told him that if he wanted to continue in the Air Force, that if he wanted to continue to fly, that he had to remain silent about this whole event. He was sworn to silence. He couldn't even tell his commanding officer what had happened. And so this is revealing another aspect of the control system, the way the policy has been created, that there is within the military a kind of military hierarchy, if you like, which operates under a strict secrecy. Because in the military, you need to think in terms of two parallel hierarchies. On the one hierarchy is the conventional hierarchy in terms of rank. So you have your four-star general, three-star general, and everything operates in rank and following orders and being subservient to people of superior rank and basically doing as they request. The next hierarchy operates in the level of secrecy. It operates in terms of your clearance, in terms of how high your clearance goes. So you may be just a lieutenant colonel, for example, which is kind of like a middle-ranking officer, but your security clearance may be much greater than a four-star general. And in that case, with this parallel system, because your security level is at a higher level, that you actually can take control when sensitive national security issues being discussed which pertain to that level of clearance that you have. So in the case of Milton Torres, this CIA, or this civilian who was basically a CIA officer, a covert officer, even though he had no formal rank in the military, because his security clearance was much higher than Milton Torres's, higher than Milton Torres's commanding officer, and probably even higher than the commanding officer of the whole base, anyone would have to follow what this CIA official had to say when it came to this issue of the UFO. And so in that case, that is why Milton Torres could be commanded to secrecy, could be commanded not to speak to his superior officer, not even to the commanding officer of the base, and basically be sworn to secrecy. And Milton Torres had to do that, otherwise his career would be forfeit. And so that just reveals another aspect of the system that has been set up over the years to take control of this whole UFO issue, which does have very high national security. One of the things that the Canadian Transport Security Minister, Mr. Rupert Smith, had made clear back in the early 50s was that the whole UFO flying saucer issue had a higher security clearance level than the hydrogen bomb. And that's a very important admission, because basically what that meant was that if you think in terms of this security system, the clearance system that I just mentioned, that meant that anything to do with UFOs, people who had a clearance in that area, they could immediately take command of this situation. And so that's why you can have these people descending onto military bases who may just be plain clothes, might not have a military rank at all, but because they could demonstrate that they had a security clearance in that area to deal with UFOs, they could immediately take command of the situation, and even a four-star general couldn't do a thing.
Thank you so much for that explanation. That information is extremely interesting. Now, Michael, I would like to, or actually, rather, now there's a mandatory network break for about 9 minutes. In the second segment, I very much would like to discuss new information you have on the Sir Eric Gary and his sighting and a visit to a crash site. Also, on the interesting Amicizia case in Italy. And also, too, lest we forget, I really would like to mention the fact that after the air raid over Los Angeles, the material obtained through FOIA requests that show that we did retrieve a craft after that very eventful incident known by some titles as Battle of Los Angeles or the Los Angeles Air Raid. Also, I've got a great question coming in from our researcher, Hagarish. And again, for our audience, please, during this 10-minute break, do visit the Exopolitics Institute website at www.exopolitics.org, or just exopolitics.org, a wonderful site. And lastly, people, please stick around. The second hour should be fascinating as well, and real treat this evening. It's going to be our debut of Erica Getch at her program, The Galact Connection, not to be missed. And I can't wait to resume this second hour of the interview with you, Michael. Everyone will be right back. Thanks.
Breaking news. Strange black pyramid UFO ships over every major city on the Earth. People are exhilarated and scared. Reptilian strange creatures are beaming down. My God! My God! They're beaming me up with them. Don't put that probe there. Don't put that probe there. Don't put the... Listen to the Judge of Mabus radio show at 11 p.m. Eastern, Saturday nights with host Jeffrey Pritchard, bringing you The High Strange. Visit www.churchofmabusradio.com. That's www.churchofmabus.com.
Radio.
Hi, everybody. This is Erica Getch, and I want to invite you to my new radio show called The Galactic Connection. It's going to be on Friday nights on the network that's called the UFO Paranormal Radio Network, and it's going to be about 8 o'clock Pacific, 9 o'clock Mountain, 10 o'clock Central, and 11 o'clock Eastern Time. And you can find out all the scheduling and all the information on how to contact me, as well as be a guest on the show and listen to the archives and everything on theconnection.com. One thing I want to mention real quick is before the show, you have to, if you want to listen to a live show, you have to get the PalTalk Messenger, and it's really quick to download, and all the information's on the website on how to do it, and you basically go in, and you can choose two options, one that gives you free software with it, and if you don't want that, just look below it, and you'll have the option just to get the Messenger. Once you get the Messenger and set up everything, and it's a really quick setup, you find the room, and it says how to do that on the website. Find the room and add to favorites, and you never have to look for it again. And every time that you want to listen to any of the network shows, you just open up your PalTalk Messenger and you click on the room, and every show's there all day long. It's really fun at a live show, so don't miss out, please. And I hope to really see you there. And if you'd like to contact me, get a hold of me at thegalacticconnection@hotmail.com or Erica Getch at Hotmail. Thanks for listening, and talk to you.
Hey, hi there. Got your attention? I'm Gia Scott, and I was curious what you were doing from 7 to 9 p.m. Central Time on Tuesdays. See, I host this really interesting little radio program that airs live then, and we bring in all sorts of guests. Authors, experiencers, and everything in between. It's paranormal and guaranteed to make you go, My guest list is always up at www.giascott.com, and do tune in to the Dawn of Shades from 7 to 9 p.m. on Tuesdays.
Tune in to the Mayan Cemetery with us, Chip and Nicole, every Monday night.
From 11 p.m. to 1 a.m. Eastern on the UFO Paranormal Radio Network, as we delve into UFOs, abduction, ghosts, aliens, conspiracy, cryptozoology.
And don't forget those creepy topics you won't hear in your local news.
That's the Mayan Cemetery, where the paranoia about the paranormal comes to rest.
Don't forget to follow us on Twitter and Facebook.
Hi, this is Rob Simone, and I want to tell you about my brand new show here on the Paranormal Radio Network. Each week, I bring you the most interesting people on the planet, the most in-depth discussions, and the most controversial issues. We go where no talk show dares to go. Join me every week for the Rob Simone Talk Show here on the UFO Paranormal Radio Network.
Hello everyone, Trish Sheridan, host of A Global Focus. Come join us each Friday evening at A Global Focus's new time, 9 to 11 p.m. Eastern. Come join the discussion.
Are you a fan of the unknown?
Do you constantly watch the sky, wondering if there's something out there?
In fear of things going bump in the night?
This is Radio brings you head first into the world of the paranormal with the latest news and interviews with the paranormal elite.
With hosts Jordan Klein and Nick Queen, you are sure to be consumed in the world of ghosts, UFOs, cryptozoology, conspiracy theories, and the unknown.
So check out Whispers Radio every Tuesday night, 6 to 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 to 7 Central. And give us a call, 1-866-514-1600.
Visit us at www.whispersradio.com.
To UFO Undercover, Wednesdays at 8 p.m. Eastern, with your host, Joe Montaldo, right here on the Paranormal Radio Network.
Hi, everyone. This is Second Sight NYC. You can join us each Thursday at 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on the UFO Paranormal Radio Network.
We're a parapsychic radio show that isn't afraid to push the limits.
We have limits.
Well, if we do, we haven't found them yet.
Chris is the godfather of psychic mediums, and he'll give you a reading you can't refuse.
You better believe it. And Stephanie is the co-hostess with the mostest.
Relax there, Chris.
Yeah, okay. Second Sight and... NYC is the show that even the spirits listen to.
How can you make such a claim?
Well, the spirits told me. Give us 2 hours to open your minds to the possibilities of what could be.
Dish out what is seen and unseen, known and unknown, and everything in between.
Each week, we make the unbelievable believable.
Join us.
Are you a fan of the unknown? Do you constantly watch the skies, wondering if there's something out there?
The mistake that people often make is that they assume that this decision that was adopted by the General Assembly is a resolution. In fact, it was not a resolution, it was a decision. The United Nations has a different way of categorizing decisions and resolutions. A resolution typically is something that many people are aware of, deals with matters of international importance. For example, you know, whether or not Palestine should be given a seat at the United Nations, those sorts of things that are the subject matter typically of resolutions. Eric Gary, his initiative, his UFO initiative was passed as a decision. And decisions are typically more kind of administrative decisions by the United Nations, or administrative type policies. For example, you know, what kind of pay does a top UN diplomat get? That kind of is an administrative issue. And curiously enough, his initiative was adopted by the Political Affairs Committee of the General Assembly as a decision, not a resolution, even though he sponsored it as a resolution. So that was all secretly an effort by United States, Britain, and others that were opposed to Sir Eric Gary's resolution ever getting anywhere, but they thought that this would be a way to kind of dampen down the effect. I think the thing that you're most interested in is, well, why did he do this? Why did he go to that effort to actually have the United Nations pass a decision on dealing with the UFO and extraterrestrial issue? Well, as you kind of mentioned, Sir Eric Gary did have his own UFO encounter. And basically what happened was that he was at a restaurant one night, and some fishermen came up to him in the restaurant. He was surrounded by bodyguards and other people. And this was the way he operated. It was a very low-key. Grenada, after all, is a small island. And so he operated in a very low-key manner. And so some fishermen came directly up to him. They had found something on the beach, and he should have a look at it. So he went over there to take a look, and he saw this giant 8-foot body of what looked like Caucasian, Nordic-looking gentleman, 8 foot tall with very long white hair. He was obviously dead, but the interesting thing about him was that he was dressed in this one-piece outfit. And so Eric Gary said that when he tested the outfit in terms of stretching it out, it would return to its former position very slowly. So it was obviously made using a fabric that was not conventional. And so Eric basically realized straight away that he was dealing with a casualty, or an extraterrestrial. He had an extraterrestrial body on his hands. And he also saw some wreckage from what looked like a UFO. So he took it all to a secure location, and that's how his UFO initiative began, because he knew that there were these extraterrestrials visiting our Earth, visiting in these vehicles, these UFOs that they've known, and that some of them are killed as a result. Who knows what was happening out there. So this is one of the things that Sir Eric was very interested in, and he wanted to give it exposure in the United Nations. And the really interesting thing here with Sir Eric, after he was successful in getting his decision passed at the General Assembly, was that on March 12th, he travelled to the United Nations to meet with Secretary General Kurt Waldheim to tell him about this incident of the dead extraterrestrial that he found at a beach in Grenada. and that on the very day that he was scheduled to meet with Secretary General Waldheim, Gary was deposed in a coup, a very strange coup, and that this was something that immediately meant that Eric Gary was no longer a head of state. He no longer had the right to speak with the Secretary General of the United Nations as the head of the state, and immediately the U.S. State Department basically took Sir Eric Gary under protective custody, and from that time on, Sir Eric's power or influence on the world stage ended.
Thank you so much for giving the details on that very intriguing account. That research is superb. And now, my two questions here. And before I do so, I just wanted to add to our audience, this is a very important note I just saw coming in here among some of our listeners, that indeed tomorrow on News on the Flip Side, they will be featuring a very thought-provoking and excellent discussion on the horrific events that occurred on 9/11, the World Trade Center events, that tragedy on 9/11. And we, 2001, we hope you'll join us for discussion, your comments. It's an excellent show. We'll very much appreciate your participating. Now, we have two fascinating questions. First of all, Michael, it's from one of our researchers, Hagerish. And he notes here that Dr. Sala has written many articles which are critical of David Icke and Alex Jones' writings and actions, or at least that's how he's perceiving them. What do you think, Michael, their agenda might be? Any comments?
Well, a very interesting way that that's framed. I wouldn't say article of David Icke or Alex Jones. I wrote an article about David Icke where I went to an actual 10-hour seminar that he held here on the island of Maui and sat through that and listened to what he had to say, and I thought, oh, there was probably, the majority of what he had to say I had no real issue with, but I did have some issues with some of the things he had to say, in particular, the way in which he focused on the reptilian species as really being the chief embodiment of evil, if you like, on the planet. That if you look at all of the things that are wrong with our world, all of the things that suggest oppression, control, manipulative entities basically controlling public policy leaders and world figures such as President Obama, that he basically points the finger at the reptilian species. And I was critical of that because I really thought that in terms of the evolution of David Icke's work, that his very first book, The Robots Rebellion, to my mind was more accurate in terms of identifying who really is responsible for the kind of sad state of affairs on much of our planet. And in that book, The Robots Rebellion, David Icke talks about this lucent consciousness and this kind of Luciferian presence, if you like, on planet Earth as being responsible. And I think that is substantially correct. As far as I'm concerned, reptilian beings are more like, like the guards at a slave labor camp. You know, look at during the Holocaust, for example. Look at these Nazi guards, right? The guards at the prison camp, and say these guys were guarding prisoners and doing all sorts of terrible things to prisoners, slave labor, and so forth, concentration camps. You know, very nasty things. But it would be almost like saying, well, you know, these camp guards are evil, mendacious beings, and you know they are the ones that are responsible for all these terrible problems. But in fact, the guards were basically following the orders of their superiors, and the superiors were basically these people in the Gestapo and people in the elite ruling structure of Nazi Germany. And so similarly, I think the reptilian species, in a sense, they're like prison guards. You know, they themselves are under pressure to do what they're told to do, otherwise they themselves can find themselves in a prison. But they are not the beings that are really responsible for what is happening on the Earth. They are, in a sense, kind of like accomplices to what is happening on the earth according to the dictates of this kind of Luciferian consciousness or this Luciferian presence that I think Ike originally correctly identified as being responsible for what's happening on the planet. Now, for Alex Jones, again, I think it's would be overstating it to say that I'm critical of Alex Jones. I like a lot of his work. I think his work in identifying red flag, false flag operations, including 9/11, is really outstanding stuff. In fact, prior to Alex Jones's work on false flag operations, I'm ashamed to say that as an academic, I really had very little of an idea of what false flag operations were. I mean, I really didn't understand that something that was very serious. I understood that false flag operations were often used in the military intelligence community, in wars and so forth, but in peacetime, that false flag operations could be conducted on a major scale. I mean, I just didn't have that worldview. So Alex Jones really helped me open up to this very real phenomenon where false flag operations are not something that happens purely during times of war by military intelligence agencies, but in fact during peacetime you have these false flag operations being contrived by these very nebulous actors. And I think 9/11 is an outstanding example of that. But where I am critical of Alex Jones is the way in which he really avoids the extraterrestrial issue. I mean, I think if you're going to be conducting analysis of geopolitical events and major false flag operations such as 9/11 that are happening around the planet, that you cannot exclude the extraterrestrial issue from your analysis. Unfortunately, the closest Alex Jones gets to including the extraterrestrial issue into his analysis is saying, on the one hand, that the powers that be are planning a false flag UFO invasion. So he talks about UFOs, but this would be a false flag event, which would be contrived. That in other words, that there's no real UFO invasion. That this would be a contrived event. And secondly, that extraterrestrials, a ruling class of extraterrestrials like the Nephilim, is part of the belief system of the powers that be, and that this is correct. I believe that he is correct in identifying it as a belief system of the powers that be, but Alex Jones basically doesn't go beyond that. He doesn't say, well, in fact, there are extraterrestrials that date back into antiquity, have played a very important role in the control and manipulation of humanity, something that frequent guests on his shows, such as David Icke and Jim Mars, have pointed out, or in other fora. So this is something that Jones would be familiar with, but he does not give that any airtime. As far as he's concerned, this is just a strange belief system of the Illuminati, that they believe that they are the descendants of these extraterrestrial visitors who came during antiquity, but Jones does not say that there is any credence to the view that extraterrestrials are currently visiting us. So in that sense, Alex Jones is still someone, still pretty much a doubting Thomas.
Thank you. That was a very thoughtful and interesting response. Now I have an excellent question from one of our superb researchers, Lily from New York, or New York Lily. But before I ask her question, Michael, you and your institute believe in the full spectrum of extraterrestrials, correct? That they can be regarding their agendas and motivations?
Yes, the good, the bad, and the indifferent.
Right, and the different creature types. We're getting a reaction here to the reptilians. We do have some referencing that they've had reptilian contacts, but I will also say that within this past week, and I don't want to name the show, because I don't want to, bring too much attention to this, but we had an excellent speaker earlier in the week who mentioned a possible atrocity committed by a reptilian, and yet we're also getting comments that, questioning, they haven't had negative incidents with reptilians. So that's an interesting question. The question here, too, that's additionally asked here is, what would be your ideas as to whom the reptilians answer to? Would that be a tremendous hierarchy, as, for example, proposed by Daryl Sims?
Well, you know, the important thing here to keep in mind with the reptilians is that replace the word reptilian with American, or replace the word reptilian with German during the Second World War, and immediately what you are confronted with is that not all Germans and not all Americans think alike. Some of them are capable of, you know, doing great atrocities, such as Nazis during the German, during the Third Reich, or those that follow a very sort of Fourth Reich philosophy in the current US administration, you know, who behind the scenes are really kind of continuing the whole Nazi program, but in a very secretive way. These people are truly evil. I mean, these are people who are really following a very Luciferian philosophy that the earth is populated by those of superior intelligence and basically a lot of sheep. And those of superior intelligence are entitled to control the sheep and use them as a resource. And if you happen to have talent and you happen to distinguish yourself amongst the sheep, well then you might rise to the position of being like a guard of the sheep, and kind of like certainly like in during the Holocaust, during the Nazi era, you had many Jews that became camp guards, and they were given certain privileges. You know, in a sense, that's very similar to the way in which the earth operates. Those who are talented, who can show themselves as having skills in certain areas, they can get promoted, and they can become CEOs of major corporations, they can become sitting presidents, senators, or they can rise to very high posts, which might seem to be a position of power, but really it's not. I mean, someone like President Obama, really Obama doesn't have that much power at all. I mean, he really is under the thumb of these secret rulers behind the scenes who dictate policy, who dictate what he can and can't do, and these powers that be, they have control files on every leading politician. The Franklin cover-up, this was a book by Jean de Camp, a very important book, because what that showed was how child pornography, child prostitution, was a way in which politicians in Washington DC were blackmailed. That politicians in Washington DC, people who showed any promise, who showed any talent, who could rise to public office, they were kind of set up with these kids in a way where they were then photographed or taped, videotaped or whatever, doing compromising things with these kids. And then basically, a control file was generated so that the real powers behind the curtain could just control these politicians at any time, just by threatening to basically reveal the secrets of what that politician was doing. So the Franklin cover-up revealed that methodology, that this is what happens. I think that something very similar exists in Obama, that the people behind the scenes that control Obama have a pretty big control file on him, where if they wanted to basically jettison him at a moment's notice, they could just kind of release this incriminating information, and President Obama would be impeached immediately. So I think this is how they control things, but ultimately the people behind the scenes, I think, do have a direct connection with this kind of Luciferian entity that David Icke originally talked about, and which Alex Jones, to his credit, spent a little bit of time talking about as well.
Thoughtful response. And you know, Michael, as well, Robert Stanley, that author and media personality, a mainstream as well journalist, and also he has his own blog talk show, has himself very strongly indicated he believes that there is a considerable Luciferian presence in D.C. Bit frightening.
Yes. Well, you know, it's very interesting. I lived in D.C. for 8 years, and it's a very powerful city. And one of the things that I think is very interesting is the way in which some of the streets were designed. Pierre L'Enfant was involved in designing the layout of Washington D.C. And if you look at it around the White House, that they erected pentagram, and one of the arms of the pentagram is inverted, And basically what that is, in the occult symbology, that's a sign for the devil or Lucifer, if you like, to be able to be captured. And so that pentagram is a means in the occult literature for capturing Lucifer or a devil. And so this, I think, is interesting that Washington, D.C. does have a very tangible Luciferian presence. And I think Robert Stanley is correct.
Thank you very much for those further comments. Now, this would suggest a positive note. That being that, I'm going to tie this in with an excellent question coming in, Michael, now from, again, our Lily from New York. She's wondering, does Dr. Sal feel that there are less government UFO whistleblowers coming forward these days, and why? And I just want to segue that in with your comment from one of your Prague presentations. It's in the synopsis. A pro-disclosure faction in the U.S. military intelligence community is a major factor behind the unprecedented number of whistleblowers that have come forward to reveal their knowledge about classified extraterrestrial-related projects.
Yes, there is definitely a very positive force within the U.S. military that recognizes that the whole ET issue has been mismanaged, that there are entities and forces that are in control of this issue that are really not acting in the best interests of the United States or the United States military and its constitution. And so I believe that basically this positive faction, whether you call them white hats or a constitutionalist branch of the U.S. military, maybe constitutionalist forces is probably a more apt term, because ultimately these people swear allegiance to the U.S. Constitution, and so they are there to protect and uphold the U.S. Constitution, and so they are opposed to policies that they see directly threaten the Constitution and the Republic. And so one of the things that became very prominent in the 1990s was the rise in the number of whistleblowers that were coming forward to basically reveal what was going on behind the scenes. And what was interesting was that many of these were allowed to come forward because they were very powerful behind-the-scenes people in the U.S. military which were encouraging this. This was a way in which people with a positive agenda, a constitutionalist focus, wanted to have the ET issue exposed, because they felt that this was a way to kind of progress and protect the Constitution. In the 90s, you had this rise, this meteoric rise in the number of whistleblowers coming forward. Stephen Greer, probably more than anyone else, did a fantastic job in organizing all of these whistleblowers that were coming forward. Stephen Greer is definitely a very important person in the whole exopolitical community and also in the UFO movement. Unfortunately, the UFO researchers have largely attacked Dr. Greer, which is very unfortunate. I think it's often people act out of petty jealousy, if you like, and I think many people in the UFO community were very jealous of Dr. Greer, just because he was successful in very quickly getting attention and being able to organize major events and getting a lot of people to come forward and to support his efforts. And I think it's because he trains outstanding public figures, and he was able to get hundreds of whistleblowers to come forward and to give their testimony. Now, all of these testimonies people are familiar with, that they are part of the Disclosure Project public record, or they were published in the Disclosure Project book that came out in 2001. But a lot of the testimonies are still confidential. We began the show talking about Neil Armstrong's relatives. I mean, that is something that was confidential, and Dr. Greer never released that up until very recently. So there's still a lot of testimonies he has that hasn't been released, just because people have not okayed that. But after Dr. Greer, then you have had a number of other people that have been very successful in getting whistleblowers to come forward. Paula Harris, a colleague of mine from the Exopolitics Institute, has had a certain degree of success in getting whistleblowers and and experiences to come forward. The Project Camelot team of Kerry Cassidy and Bill Ryan have also done a great job in encouraging a lot of people to come forward who have served in the military to reveal what was going on. And so they've kind of continued the work that Dr. Greer began. In 2001, he kind of moved into the new energy arena, stopped giving kind of primacy to the disclosure issue and was working in the new energy era issue. And Camelot people have kind of like since 2005, 2006, played that role of getting a lot of these testimonies out. But I think the ultimate result is that in the United States, we're very fortunate because of all the countries on the planet, we are the only country with so many whistleblowers who have direct experience, whether in the military, whether in the corporate world, or whether in the government sector, of these secret projects dealing with UFOs and extraterrestrial life. And these people are coming forward, and to a certain degree, they are being protected in making their admissions. And that's critical, that they can come forward and that they receive protection.
Powerful argument there. And now, Michael, also I noted, I believe it was your second presentation, it gives a wonderful description or explanation of the evolution of unofficial public policy regarding regarding UFOs. And I was amazed. Regarding the Los Angeles air raid, you mentioned that that air raid itself occurring in 1942, and you mentioned February 25th, 1942, air raid alert over Los Angeles, and you even played at your presentation a journalist piece at the time concerning that event. But what really floored me was information you had as to a March 5th, 1942 top secret memo. Now, this would have been the month just after this air raid alert over Los Angeles. And in this March 5th, 42 top secret memo by General George Marshall, it indicates that the U.S. Navy recovered an extraterrestrial vehicle from the Los Angeles air raid. And also it references that the top secret unit was created within the Army, the Interplanetary Phenomenon Unit. And I guess there's a reference here to possible craft from San Bernardino Mountains, east of Los Angeles. Really fascinating. And you have further research, for example, a FOIA request made by a number of individuals, including Timothy Good, that the Interplanetary Phenomenon Unit did exist. And it's fascinating. Thanks. Could you just give the details on this? You could so much better describe than I could.
Yes, it's a very important incident, that Los Angeles air raid from February of 1942, because what that incident revealed was that there was obviously what appeared in the major media as an incident that happened, where there were thousands of pieces of artillery fired at basically UFOs, because there was no explanation given for what it was that they were firing at. That it wasn't a Japanese invasion, because the US was at war at that time, and there was a mystery over what it was that was actually the air raid warning was all about. But there are subsequent memos that have been released. Now, that memo that you talked about, that you mentioned from George Marshall, there were a number of memos by high policy figures that revealed what had really happened with the Los Angeles raid. That memo by George Marshall, for example, saying that this was an extraterrestrial incident. Now, the memo itself belongs to the Majestic documents. The Majestic files are basically a series of documents that have been leaked over the years, which reveal key incidents in terms of how the UFO, how the extraterrestrial issue has been secretly managed behind the scenes. And so these Majestic documents, many of them are, to my mind, very accurate and genuine. And a number of UFO researchers have studied these documents. And while I don't agree that all of them are genuine, very prominent UFO researchers, such as Stanton Friedman, have been able to conclude favorably that some of these Majestic documents are accurate. Now, the Marshall memo is amongst those documents, and it refers to a secretive unit called the Interplanetary Phenomenon Unit that he was given orders, with Roosevelt had okayed the creation of this unit to basically take charge and study the UFO phenomenon. And it makes perfect sense. If you think about it, the United States was at war. You have this phenomenon, this UFO phenomenon, that is manifesting itself. And, of course, national security figures would be very interested in what's behind all this, and you could well understand that they would create a unit, a top secret unit, to investigate this phenomenon and make policy recommendations for how to deal with it. The Interplanetary Phenomenon Unit can be traced to 1942 at the earliest, and interesting enough, one of the key figures involved in that was General Douglas MacArthur, who also he was running the Japanese theater of operations for the U.S. Army. He was the supreme commander of the Allied forces in Japan after the war, ran the Philippines and so forth. So this was a man who was a very, very senior military official, a five-star general, and he played a role in the Interplanetary Phenomenon Unit. Now, what's really significant is that the Interplanetary Phenomenon Unit was created as early as 1942, and it conducted its operations and did its work, and then later on it went through some sort of transition and it was renamed and moved on. But the important thing was that there was a FOIA document where the U.S. Air Force acknowledged that the Interplanetary Phenomenon Unit actually did exist, that it was a real unit. In the FOIA document, the colonel that actually wrote the response said that the Interplanetary Phenomenon Unit was set up and disbanded in the early 1950s, and that it was never operationalized, not that any missions and so forth. Basically, saying that, well, this was a unit that was created, but it never really did anything, so, you know, forget all about it. But of course, the important thing here was that here's an acknowledgement by the Air Force that in fact this Interplanetary Phenomenon Unit did exist, and that gives indirect support for some of these majestic documents referring to the Interplanetary Phenomenon Unit. And that is very important, because now we know that the Majestic documents did have accurate references to some ongoing operational units that were secretly studying this phenomenon.
Thank you. Those details are appreciated. And, you know, Michael, here I'd like to reference, we have probably about 8 minutes left, and I want you also to describe the latest semester there at Exopolitics Institute. My two final questions would relate to the human bearing alien aspect. For example, you reference the assessment, the NATO Commission study. It's described by Robert Dean, Command Sergeant, who was at the time Command Sergeant Major at NATO Supreme Headquarters for the Allied Powers in Europe. Very, very interesting as to the problems presented by ETs who looked so human that they could infiltrate perhaps military forces or the government. And then I had a question about that mass contact case, the Amicizia case. But first of all, your comments on the assessment and then that Amicizia case. I've heard details on this, but your research to me sounds compelling, very compelling.
Well, let me begin with the Robert Dean, the assessment. That became known in 1991, where Robert Dean first came out in public and basically began to reveal what he had experienced back in 1964. And so that was something that had happened 27 years earlier. So Robert Dean was basically someone who had a lot of credibility. He was a Command Sergeant Major, which is the most senior rank you can get in the Army. And he basically revealed that he was given access to this top secret document called the assessment, And as you mentioned, that it had a number of elements in there dealing with extraterrestrials, and one of them was the concern amongst NATO leaders that these extraterrestrials look so much like us that they could easily infiltrate the NATO hierarchy and even infiltrate the White House itself. So this was a very important document because it was something acknowledging that, in fact, we are not only being visited by extraterrestrial visitors, but that some of these look very much like us and that they could walk in the street and not be noticed. So this was something that was mentioned in the assessment. And the assessment overlaps with a very important case that you mentioned called Amicizia, or the friendship case. From the years 1957 up until 1978, a group of extraterrestrials, calling themselves the Friends, had a base in the northeast of Italy and also under the Adriatic, there off the coast, off the northeast coast of Italy, and that they met with various Italian citizens and also citizens from other countries, Germany, Austria, and so forth, and that they basically began to introduce these visitors to some of the operations of the extraterrestrial visitors, and this was something that involved 100 or more visitors, or sorry, 100 or more human contactees. So this is where the Amicizia case is the biggest case of contact that is known on record. There is no other case involving contact with so many witnesses of the extraterrestrials that are involved. And some of the witnesses were very high-level people, people like ambassadors, generals, and so forth, that were involved in this. And this basically revealed that during the time of the NATO assessment, where the extraterrestrial phenomenon was being studied, you had also in a NATO country, Italy, this phenomenon where extraterrestrials were operating in the street, if you like, meeting with ordinary Italian citizens, also meeting with high-level Italian officials. And typically the Italian citizens were cooperating with the extraterrestrials, delivering truckloads of fruit and so forth, and food and so forth to them. So this is a case that suggests that the Italian authorities were closely monitoring the extraterrestrial visitors and observing them, that there was no attempt to kind of like remove them or go to war against them, that it was really just monitoring and placing the extraterrestrials under surveillance. And this was over that period from 1957 up until 1978. So I think that the NATO assessment was partly based on the surveillance of these extraterrestrials that were identified in the Amicizia case in Italy. And then, of course, that Robert Dean read about the consequences later in 1964 and then revealed it all in 1991. So I think the two cases, the Amicizia case and the assessment, actually do have a very clear relationship, and both of them basically reveal that some extraterrestrials look like us and they can actually operate in the streets or operate in society without us knowing. Our next-door neighbor may, in fact, be a visitor and we wouldn't even know.
Very thought-provoking comments. Thank you. Now, Michael, we have 2 minutes remaining to the show. I'd like you, please, to just give a description of the current semester and the upcoming semesters there at Exopolitics Institute, and also any presentations you'll be making in the near future, any of the other instructors as well. And also, thank you, last week, the show with David Greer, who is one of the editors at your Exopolitics Journal. You being the chief editor of the Exopolitics Journal was very informative. So please take us out there. We have about a minute and a half left.
Okay, so that was David Griffin from last week.
David Griffin, yes.
Yes, yes. The Exopolitics Institute, we have a number of ongoing programs. And you mentioned the courses. We have just begun the courses this semester. And one of the courses is being is called Hollywood and UFO Disclosure, and that is something that Paola Harris is conducting, and so certainly there is time yet to register for that course. People can also go to my website, exopolitics.org, and they get to observe introductory lecture to a course that I've taught twice before, which is the science, politics, and spirituality of extraterrestrial civilizations. So you can go to my website, exopolitics.org, and you can get information about viewing that video. We have an Exo News website where we publish articles dealing with extraterrestrials, UFOs that have an exopolitical element. So that's an ongoing project. We have a number of articles that appear each week, so that's something I recommend. People can just go to exonews.org. We have the Exopolitics Journal, which is designed for more of an academic audience, people who like to write or people who like to read kind of longer referenced articles rather than the kind of more layman's news type articles. They can go to Exopolitics Journal and to find out about it there. I recommend that you go, your listeners can go to my website, exopolitics.org. They can subscribe there to the news feed, to my Twitter page or Facebook page, and that way they'll get all the latest information about my ongoing research, upcoming engagements, presentations, articles, and so forth. And I just want to thank you, Chris, for having me on the show and just giving this, providing me the opportunity to be able to talk about exopolitics and ongoing developments. And if it weren't for shows like yours, life would be so much harder.
I so appreciated your being featured as a guest this evening. I've learned so very much. Michael, you know, last week with David Griffin, very intriguing information was presented, very intriguing research for conjecture and for very serious thought. And this week, with yourself and the research, the articles, your books, you present a body of research that is extremely compelling and multifaceted and a real credit to the field. Thanks again, So, for being a guest, and thank you to our audience for joining us this evening. We appreciate it. And everyone, don't forget, coming up right now, the debut of The Galactic Connection with host Erica Getch. Great weekend. Bye-bye, and thank you again, Michael. Dr. Sala, I was so pleased. It was an honor to interview you again.
Motivation. Let it be like